Infrastructure week has finally arrived. How many times you hear over the last 5 years, infrastructure week is coming?
President Biden touts his bipartisan infrastructure bill during a visit to Baltimore. But with inflation surging to a 30-year high, the question is, what does it mean for the economy? We'll go live to CNBC. Plus, a dramatic day of testimony in the Kyle Rittenhouse trial. We saw Rittenhouse himself break down in tears and an irate judge yelling in the courtroom. The question is, will we see a mistrial? And a federal judge overrules Texas Governor Greg Abbott's ban on mask mandates in schools. The question is, how will this impact legal battles in other states? It's way too early for this. Good morning and welcome to Way Too Early, the show that thanks all our veterans for their service. I'm John Lemire on this Thursday, November 11th, Veterans Day. We'll start with the news. The White House is addressing economic worries about a report yesterday showed a 6.2% spike in consumer prices. A statement from President Biden reads this: I have directed my National Economic Council to pursue means to try to further reduce these costs and have asked the Federal Trade Commission to strike back at any market manipulation or price gouging in this sector. At what was supposed to be a celebration of the passage of his trillion-dollar infrastructure bill, President Biden instead had a promise to tackle inflation.
Today's economic report showing unemployment continued to fall, but consumer prices remain too high. Tell us, the American people, in the midst of this economic crisis, the recovery is showing strong results, but not to them. They're still looking out there. Everything from a gallon of gas to a loaf of bread costs more, and it's worrisome, even though wages are going up. We still face challenges, and we have to tackle them. We have to tackle them head on.
Meanwhile, the White House was put on defense yesterday after Senator Joe Manchin criticized the Biden administration's argument that inflation will be short-lived. Senator Manchin, whose vote, of course, is critical to enacting the president's social spending bill, cited rising inflation as a reason to pause some parts of Biden's economic agenda. The senator from West Virginia tweeted this: by all accounts, the threat posed by record inflation to the American people is not transitory and is instead getting worse. From the grocery store to the gas pump, Americans know the inflation tax is real, and D.C. can no longer ignore the economic pain Americans feel every day. The House Republicans, meanwhile, who backed the bipartisan infrastructure bill, are facing fierce and sometimes violent reactions. The New York Times reports several of the 13 GOP House lawmakers have received threatening messages since their vote in favor of passage. One caller instructed Representative Adam Kinzinger of Illinois to slit his wrists and, quote, rot in hell. Another hoped that Representative Don Bacon of Nebraska would slip and fall down a staircase. And the office of Representative Nicole Malliotakis of New York has been inundated with angry messages tagging her as a traitor. The Times continues: the dynamic is a natural outgrowth of the slash and burn politics of former President Donald J. Trump, who savaged those in his party who backed the infrastructure bill as rhinos, Republicans in name only, who should be ashamed of themselves. Extreme supporters of the former president followed his lead in calling out their colleagues. Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia posted the phone numbers of the House members on her social media pages. Former advisor to Trump, Steve Bannon, meanwhile, sent out the numbers of the senators who backed the legislation. Several congressional aides tell the Times the majority of threatening calls have come from citizens outside the lawmakers' districts, and many complaints about the bill conflate the separate pieces of legislation. NBC News has obtained a call sent to Congressman Fred Upton of Michigan. Listen up, but we warn you, this could be disturbing.
F***ing traitor. That's what you are. You're a f***ing piece of traitor. I hope you die. I hope everybody in your f***ing family dies.
That is hard to listen to. And joining us now, White House correspondent for Politico and co-author of The Playbook, Eugene Daniels. He's an MSNBC contributor, and as of Tuesday, will be my new colleague. Eugene, great to
see
you here.
Welcome to the family.
Thank you, buddy. I'm excited to get started at Politico next week. But I am glad you're here with us this morning. Thanks for getting up so early. Let's start right there with those threats to lawmakers. Just speak, if there's something that, whether it's Law House or the White House or Capitol Police, how are they getting involved? How are they investigated? But more than that, just speak more broadly about just how broken our politics are right now.
I mean, I don't know if people saw it. I was kind of shaking my head and listening to that message that was left for Fred Upton, because this is something that we've seen before and it's happening with more frequency. But you also have lawmakers for kind of the first time being a lot more open about it, right? This is something that we've seen happen to AOC, Ayanna Pressley, a lot of other members of Congress on the left. And now what you're seeing is the right attack its own. And like you said, this has almost everything to do with Donald Trump. Because Donald Trump's edict has always been overpower, never give in, and most importantly, never give the other side a win. And so when that is the mantra of a party for 4+ years, now you have everyday folks calling lawmakers and telling them they hope they die, to slit their wrists, these kinds of things that are vile and disgusting. And it's hard to come back from that. And it's unclear how we do that as a country, because it is a problem not just for Republicans to deal with, right? This is happening to Congress people on the left as well. And so it's one of those things that as Washington, D.C., has kind of coarsened their language for years, and the ways that they talk to and about each other. This is the end result of that.
So, Eugene, let's circle back to those inflation concerns. Months now, White House aides were quietly saying they were worried about supply chain issues, about rising prices. And it's obviously surged to the forefront in these recent weeks and threatens, we head to the holidays, to become perhaps even the dominant political story. We heard those concerns from Senator Manchin. Right now, these worries about inflation, how may they affect Democrats' efforts to get a vote on the president's Build Back Better package? Are there going to be other lawmakers who express a note of caution about proceeding right now, putting more federal money into the system?
No, I think so. Manchin is usually never the only person who feels a certain way when he's talking, right? He's usually kind of the proxy for other conservative, moderate Democrats. You're right. The White House had not wanted to talk about inflation. We were in those briefing rooms begging them to talk about it. And they kind of, sometimes they would say that it don't worry about it, it's going to go away soon. And that doesn't speak to what the anxieties that people actually have when they're seeing rising costs. So you see, and you guys played this earlier, the president and the White House talking more about inflation, and they have to kind of steady their political standing. They're seeing their numbers go down, and it puts them in this kind of tough position where they have to thread the needle between the idea that, hey, progress is being made, look at BIF, BBB is coming down the line, but also it can't appear out of touch or too happy, too much happy talk for folks, because then normal voters don't understand that. And I will say on whether or not the BBB bill will cause more inflation, even Larry Summers, who feels like this is a White House that doesn't fully understand inflation, doesn't understand that it's not, according to him, transitory. He has said the spending bills aren't going to be an inflation problem because they're paid for by tax increases, and basically says that they're good investments. So that's a good thing for this White House that they can talk about, because he hasn't exactly been their friend on inflation for the last few months.
Now, you're certainly right about that. It's rare to see the White House tout Larry Summers as a voice, as an advocating voice, but they did in this case. Politico's Eugene Janos, thank you so much, pal. We'll talk to you again soon. The same real federal judge who refused to block the release of documents from the Trump administration to the Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection rejected the former president's latest attempt to prevent those records from being turned over. Late last night, U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan denied a request for an emergency injunction filed by former President Trump's lawyers a day after her initial ruling. She wrote this: "The court will not effectively ignore its own reasoning in denying injunctive relief in the first place to grant injunctive relief now." She added that there's still time to file an appeal, though Trump's attorneys have yet to do so. The National Archives plans to turn Trump's White House records over to the Select Committee tomorrow. Representatives from the former president did not immediately respond to a request for comment. A group of House Republicans are looking to censure their Arizona colleague, Paul Gosar, after the congressman posted a threatening, obscene video. In a letter yesterday, the Democrats announced plans to introduce a resolution tomorrow in response to the violent imagery. That edited video shows an anime character with Gosar's face killing a character depicted as New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. We're not going to show it here. In a separate shot, Gosar's character also slashes President Biden with a weapon. The Republican defended posting the video on Twitter and Instagram, calling it a, quote, symbolic cartoon. and certainly connected to our conversation earlier about just how ugly and violent our politics have gotten. Still ahead, the number of young children getting vaccinated against coronavirus is ramping up. What the president's top COVID advisor is saying about that. Plus, we'll talk to a former prosecutor about yesterday's dramatic testimony in the Kyle Rittenhouse case and the possibility of a mistrial being granted. Those stories and a check on the weather as we look at pre-dawn Washington, D.C. We'll be back in a few minutes.
Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at MSNBC.com/win.
Hey, everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Days after the deadly Astroworld concert, new information is surfacing about emergency communications that might have hindered a more rapid response. All this as a survivor speaks out about her experience. NBC News correspondent Morgan Chesky has the latest.
I accepted the fact that I might have died.
For Gabby Simeone, the Friday night flashbacks are haunting. Her screams caught on camera after the 17-year-old's knee popped when crowds knocked her down. Her phone accidentally recording the moments she thought were her last.
Six or seven people were on top of me at one point.
Her friend pulling her to safety just seconds later.
Thought I was going to lose her, and that scared me the most, honestly.
The Houston police chief responding to calls for an independent investigation, defending his meeting with Travis Scott before the show.
Somebody's referring to a special relationship. If you call meeting him twice, special relationship, that's not a close relationship to me.
As investigators pore over those critical concert minutes, a stunning admission from Houston's fire chief. When asked if his department had any communication with organizers during the show, said,
"No, we didn't have on scene. We did not have direct communications with those organizers. No."
Firefighters not the only ones feeling cut off from the crisis.
Being in this crowd is literally a life threat. That was apparent.
EMT Remington Richardson shared on social media how he fought through crowds to reach fans who passed out. His mission made even harder, with blaring music drowning radio calls for backup. Richardson forced to bypass the less injured as he tried to save critical patients.
I had to tell all of them, I will try to come back for you, but people are literally dead right now that I need to go help.
Our thanks to NBC's Morgan Chesky for that report. In the fight against the COVID-19 pandemic, the Biden administration announced major progress in the vaccine rollout for younger children. The White House COVID coordinator gave this update yesterday.
While our program is just fully up and running this week, by the end of the day today, we estimate that over 900,000 kids ages 5 through 11 will have already gotten their first shot. And through pharmacies alone, 700,000 additional appointments are already on the calendar at local pharmacies. Parents and families across the country are breathing giant sighs of relief, and we are just getting started.
A federal judge in Texas has struck down Governor Greg Abbott's executive order banning mask mandates in schools. The move sets the stage for school districts in the state to decide whether they want to impose mask rules. In a 29-page ruling, the judge ruled a federal law enacted in 1990 supersedes Abbott's July order banning facial coverings in schools, adding the ban violates the Americans with Disabilities Act. The ruling also prohibits Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton from enforcing the governor's order, which imposes a fine of up to $1,000 for any entity that issues a mask mandate. Still ahead, an overenthusiastic NBA announcer, a moment of silence in Houston, and a 105-year-old Louisiana woman sets a new world record. It's all coming up in a variety package on sports. We'll be right back.
Here on MSNBC, we are staying on top of several fast-moving stories.
Today's news requires more facts.
A new report finds the climate crisis is getting much worse.
More context.
We are seeing record numbers of people crossing into the United States just in the southern border.
And more ground covered.
The mission will continue to carry out regime change in the Gaza Strip.
The world's never been harder to understand. That's why it's never been more important to try. MSNBC. Understand more.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
Jackson's going to go to the bench and lick his wounds. He's replaced by Brandon Clark. LaMelo! Oh, a double clutch, Dipsy Doo, boom! Getting by five. Loose, picked up by Plumlee. Here comes Rozier. He's got Miles! Oh! Yowza! Humdinley D! That was incredible!
A very animated Hornets announcer, Eric Collins, showing an energy level that we need here on Way Too Early every day. He was impressed with dunks last night during Charlotte's 118-108 win over the Memphis Grizzlies. Whew. To Los Angeles, both the Lakers and the Heat missing their biggest stars. LA's LeBron James still sidelined by a strained abdominal muscle. Miami's Jimmy Butler going down in the opening period with a sprained ankle. They both left the work to their supporting cast. After a slow start, the Lakers erase a nine-point deficit late in the fourth quarter to tie the game and nearly win at the buzzer. There, no. But they outlast the Heat in overtime for a 120-117 victory. It was supposed to be Travis Scott Day in Houston, but the Rockets nixed the promotion, designed to celebrate the hometown rapper after a deadly crowd surge claimed 8 lives during his set at the Astroworld Music Festival last weekend. Instead, the Rockets held a moment of silence for the victims ahead of last night's game against the Pistons. As for the action on the court, Houston skidded to a 9th straight loss, dropping to 1-10 on the season. Detroit got behind a season-high 35 points by Jeremy Grant on the way to a 112-104 win. In the NFL, more coronavirus concerns have struck the Minnesota Vikings this week, including a vaccinated player who was hospitalized Tuesday night. Head coach Mike Zimmer told reporters yesterday the player was admitted to the ER because he was having trouble breathing. While Zimmer did not name the player, who he said remained in the hospital yesterday in stable condition, NFL Network reports it was offensive lineman Dakota Dozier, who was placed on the team's reserve COVID-19 list on Friday. The Vikings currently have 5 players on that list. Meanwhile, a potential landing spot for free agent receiver Odell Beckham Jr. According to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, the Green Bay Packers are offering him a veteran minimum contract to join the team and the Aaron Rodgers soap opera. That would pay Beckham, now in his 8th NFL season, about $500,000 to play the rest of the year. Beckham was released by the Browns earlier this week. ESPN reports he's also eyeing a spot, potentially, with the Kansas City Chiefs or New Orleans Saints. The New England Patriots, Bill Belichick, has always liked Beckham. They're talking too, but it seems unlikely to find a match. And finally, a new world record in the 100-meter dash by 105-year-old Julia Hurricane Hawkins. She completed the race in just over a minute, becoming the first woman 105 or older to run the event. The Louisiana native, however, she was not happy with her time, telling the National Senior Games Association that she was hoping to beat the minute mark. Well, let's hope she does next time. That is inspiring to see. Time now for the weather, and let's go to meteorologist Michelle Grossman. Michelle, what's the forecast looking like today?
Good morning, Jonathan. Well, we're looking at a huge storm system in the middle of the country. So wintry weather on the northern plains and then severe weather, strong storms on the southern or the warmer part of the front. So let's take a look at where this is located. You can see it right in the middle of the country. It's going to take us long trek over the next 48 hours, bringing us that rain, the wind, the snow ahead of it. So today, rain chances in the upper Midwest, also the northern plains, could even see up to 9 inches in some spots. Strong storms race through the Tennessee Valley. We're going to see rain and wind in the southeast as well. And then the northeast, you are in for it on your morning commute. It's going to be a little bit slower with gusty winds, also some slow travel from D.C. to Boston with that heavy rain. But then it's out of here by the afternoon. Then New England gets in on the action later on Friday. And then it becomes about a cold weather story once this cold front moves through. So your snow forecast in the northern plains, we're looking up to 9 inches in some spots. Rain forecast anywhere from a half inch up to an inch in some spots, again, with that slow morning commute. Peak winds gusting near 65 miles per hour in some spots. And we're looking at some severe weather, Jonathan, this morning, but in the southern plains, but we're going to be seeing improving conditions by later on this afternoon. Back to you.
Michelle Grossman, thank you very much for that. Still ahead, we'll turn to yesterday's dramatic day in court, where Kyle Rittenhouse took the stand in his own defense. We'll bring in a legal expert to discuss new calls from the defense to clear a mistrial in the case. But before we go to break, we want to know, are you awake? Email your reasons to waytooearly@msnbc.com or tweet me, @JonLemire. Be sure to use the hashtag waytooearly. We'll read our favorite answers later in the show. Welcome back to Way Too Early. It's just before 5:30 on the East Coast, 2:30 out West. I'm Jonathan Lemire. It was a dramatic day in a Wisconsin courtroom as Kyle Rittenhouse took the witness stand in his own murder trial, telling the jurors he acted in self-defense in August last year when he killed two people during a protest in Kenosha. Rittenhouse broke down during the testimony, and the judge had to call a recess. NBC News correspondent Gabe Gutierrez has the details.
The truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth shall help you God.
Yes.
As he described for the jury the tense moments before he opened fire, Kyle Rittenhouse broke down.
There were three people right there.
Take a deep breath, Kyle.
That's what I...
The judge calling a short break. Some jurors appearing sympathetic as they walked out. Rittenhouse's mother within earshot, sobbing. It was a dramatic seventh day of testimony in the trial where the now 18-year-old faces six charges, including intentional homicide after shooting and killing two men and wounding another during last year's protest in Kenosha, Wisconsin, following the police shooting of Jacob Blake.
I didn't do anything wrong. I defended myself.
Rittenhouse, speaking publicly at length for the first time, described how he'd come to Kenosha to provide medical aid and protect property from rioters, and how the first man he shot, Joseph Rosenbaum, had chased him.
I didn't notice Mr. Rosenbaum until he came out from behind the car and ambushed me.
He says Rosenbaum had threatened him earlier at least twice, yelling,
"If I catch any of you alone, I'm going to kill you."
The prosecution then began an aggressive cross-examination.
Everybody that you shot at that night, you intended to kill, correct?
I didn't intend to kill them. I intended to stop the people who were attacking me.
You made an intentional decision in the middle of that incident to turn and point the gun at Mr. Rosenbaum, correct?
Yes.
But with the jury out of the room, the judge suddenly raised his voice.
Don't get brazen with me.
Admonishing the prosecutor, accusing him of improperly trying to introduce testimony that the judge had earlier prohibited.
You're an experienced trial attorney, and you're telling me that when the judge says, "I'm excluding this," you just to take it upon yourself to put it in because you think that you've found a way around it? Come on.
Our thanks to Gabe Gutierrez for that report. The defense, meanwhile, is asking for a mistrial with prejudice over what it claims are out-of-bound questions from the prosecution. The judge did not immediately rule on that request. Joining us now to talk about all this, former prosecutor Kristen Gibbons Fedden. She is an MSNBC legal analyst. Good morning. Thank you so much for being here. Let's start with that, the defense's request for a mistrial with prejudice. Explain to the audience what that means, what it would take to get there, and what it would mean for Rittenhouse if it were granted.
If a mistrial with prejudice is granted, John, he'll be let off. He'll basically be acquitted, and double jeopardy will attach. And that basically means that the prosecutor will not have the chance to retry him. That would be that they wouldn't get another bite of the apple. Essentially, what the defense needs to prove is that the prosecutor engaged in bad faith and that it prejudiced the defendant. Now, based on the comments from the judge, it's very clear that the judge kind of believes that the prosecutor engaged in bad faith, specifically when the prosecutor began to ask the defendant about statements, post-arrest statements. You know, a defendant is always entitled to the right to silence, and he does not have to talk, and the prosecutor is not allowed to elicit that type of testimony. In addition to that, the prosecutor attempted to elicit testimony that the judge already excluded. And so in that way, the defense is going to allege that the prosecutor engaged in bad faith. And based on what the judge said, when he said to the prosecutor he did not believe him, it's likely the judge will find that the prosecutor engaged in bad faith. But the defense will still need to prove that it prejudiced the defendant. And I think that if the judge gives cautionary instructions during the jury instructions before the jury deliberates, it can probably eliminate any harm or prejudice to the defendant.
So, Kristen, you obviously are a former prosecutor. If you were prosecuting this case, if you were in this prosecutor's shoes, what would your self-assessment be at this point? We just obviously heard him being admonished by the judge. How would you assess the case? Is he potentially losing it?
You know, I think the prosecution has an uphill battle. It's a very challenging case. You know, unlike some of the other high-profile cases where we have very clear video of a really horrendous murder, in these cases, we have grainy video. It's not quite clear. It's not all together. So the prosecutor has a really tough job to try to prove that, you know, basically that Kyle Rittenhouse is a cold-blooded murderer, particularly when in this state, the prosecutor has to disprove beyond all reasonable doubt that Kyle Rittenhouse, you know, engaged in self-defense. However, I will say, up until yesterday, I would have said that the prosecutor really does it. I would assess the case as, you know, it would be towards acquittal. However, the prosecutor did elicit some really good cross-examination testimony from Kyle Rittenhouse, who really, you know, didn't have to take the stand, and quite frankly, on the direct examination, came off very well. But towards the end of the cross-examination, the prosecutor did prove some of the legal technicalities that he needed to prove, such as that Kyle Rittenhouse really didn't, in fact, have a reasonable belief that his life was in threat. For example, he elicited testimony that none of these individuals had any guns, or at least the one did, but it wasn't pointed at him. None of them had any other type of weapons. None of them had them aimed at them. And the other thing that I think was really powerful testimony that the prosecutor was able to elicit was the fact that, you know, after he killed Rosenbaum, he was running around with a gun and could have potentially been provoking any of the other two victims to attack him because he had just killed another person. So I think that's really bad testimony for the defense and can right. blow away the self-defense argument.
Chris, let me ask you one last. If you could maybe briefly assess what you saw from Rittenhouse himself on the stand yesterday, the decision to have him up there, you know, how he came across. I know, as we just said, there were some of the jury who looked perhaps sympathetic. I know some of the posting of people, observers watching who post on social media, perhaps less so, thought he was perhaps less convincing in his emotions. What was your sense of how he did, how he came across yesterday?
Honestly, I thought he came off really well on direct examination. Keep in mind, John, he is a 17-year-old kid. You know, and it really, when he started to cry, you know, it's not just, the jury doesn't just see Kyle Rittenhouse. They're also going to see his mom. And what it does is it really humanizes the defendant. It undermines the prosecution's narrative that this is a cold-blooded killer.
All right. Kristen Gebbins-Fedden, we super appreciate you being here today with all your insight. Please come back soon. We'll certainly be paying attention to this trial as it continues. Still ahead, what the highest inflation level in 30 years spells for the future of the U.S. economy. We'll get a live report from CNBC as we start doing regular business segments here on Way Too Early. We'll be right back. Prices jumped way more than expected last month. The Consumer Price Index rose 0.9% in October to a 30-year high. And for the year ending in October, prices are up 6.2%. Economists have been predicting a decade-high reading on the CPI, with supply chain shortages and increased demand pushing prices higher. Food costs rose 5.3%. Gas is up about 50%. And energy costs are up 30%. For more on that, let's bring in CNBC's Juliana Tattelbaum, live from London. Juliana, good morning. Thank you so much for being here. So obviously, this rise in consumer prices is happening just before the Thanksgiving holiday here in the U.S. And as Congress intends to vote on another massive spending package, how big of a warning sign are these numbers?
Jonathan, good morning, and thanks for having me. So these numbers came in stronger than the market had been expecting. You mentioned the headline consumer price index there showing the biggest inflation surge in more than 30 years. Core inflation came in showing the biggest gain since August 1991. So these are some pretty hefty numbers. In terms of what matters here, policymakers have been arguing for some time that the current price pressures are temporary and related to the pandemic. They have conceded, though, recently that they are likely to linger a little bit longer than they had been originally anticipating. But if they are wrong and they stick around for even longer and become even more broad-based, it could have some pretty serious implications for interest rates, meaning that the Federal Reserve may be forced to raise interest rates more quickly than currently anticipated.
So a lot of this, of course, supply chain issues, and there are dozens of cargo ships still waiting off the California coast. What efforts are being put in place to improve, beef up that part of the supply chain?
So companies around the world have been battling with these supply chain challenges as industrial production struggles to keep up with this surge in demand that we've seen as economies have reopened. And now, following the passage of that big infrastructure bill in Washington last week, the Biden administration has outlined several initiatives to try to alleviate immediate pressure on supply chain. So some of the measures that are going to come through: billions in construction work at ports, and also improved data sharing between terminal operators, railroads, truckers, warehouses, and cargo owners, because one of the key reasons for these bottlenecks is thought to be the lack of communication among all these different groups.
CNBC's Juliana Tattelbaum, we really appreciate it. She's live from London. Thank you so much. And as noted, we're going to start doing more regular business segments here on the show. Still ahead, after more than a decade in the U.S. Senate, Republican Roy Blunt announced in March he will not be seeking re-election in Missouri. Up next, we'll hear from a Democrat looking to fill that seat. Don't go anywhere. Today marks Veterans Day, the first in 20 years with the nation not at war. It comes just months after President Biden withdrew U.S. forces from Afghanistan, ending the longest war in our country's history. According to the Defense Department, some 800,000 American troops served that conflict since October 2001. Among them is our next guest, Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate in Missouri, Marine veteran Lucas Kuntz. Lucas, thank you so much for being here. You've talked about that the way the nation left Afghanistan is still a huge topic among the voters that you speak to. Obviously, those first few days, very tumultuous, harrowing images, and then real concerns about whether U.S. soldiers and our Afghan friends were able to get out. How do you explain to your potential constituents the U.S. is leaving Afghanistan, and did you support the withdrawal?
Yeah, it's wild, actually. You know, still several months later, when I go around the state to just all these different towns, people still, that's one of the first things they ask me is, what happened with Afghanistan? Like, there's still this shock. You know, I was at a farm in Palmyra the other day, and these farmers, we're talking ag issues, just wanted to know, like how this happened. And I just tell them, you know, here's the deal. Like, you were systematically lied to for 20 years. We all were. I thought when I was going there that I was doing something good. And it's just like, there was just this systematic honesty that told us for 20 years that the lives lost, the trillions of dollars spent were somehow worth it. And we did all see that collapse. And so people are still just shocked by it. For me, you know, it's just, it's actually fascinating because then I tell them, you know, I was there. And when I was there after 13 years, we could tell that it wasn't going to work out. Like, this is what people deeply believe. It's what they understand. It's what they know happened. And they just, you know, when they hear it from someone who was actually there, they're just like, yeah, you know, okay, I got it. That's what's going on. And, you know, you mentioned Veterans Day a second ago, and we're going to have one of those days where everybody's posting on Facebook or Twitter or whatever else, you know, thank you for your service. Let's honor our veterans today and all these other things. And a lot of them, it's going to be the same politicians who for those 20 years were willing to spend $6.4 trillion overseas and send us over there. And now they're just squabbling about spending any dime, you know, here in our own country. And so for me, like, if they really want to honor veterans on Veterans Day, what they can do is invest in the communities that we all signed up to serve. I mean, I signed up to serve my community in Jeff City. And I go to Iraq and Afghanistan. And when I came home, you know, things were frequently worse. And it's just, it really hurts to know that so many of us went to serve our communities. And then, you know, we watched us spend all this money over there, build up other countries, and not do anything here at home.
So right now, you're obviously running for office in Missouri, a state that has grown increasingly red, Republican, in recent years. How do you break through with your message there, and how can it be applied elsewhere in the Midwest, where Democrats have struggled in recent cycles?
So for us, it's not like a left-right Democrat-Republican campaign. It's a top-bottom campaign, and it really goes back to, I mean, I can tie this into Afghanistan. Like, again, we have a set of politicians on both sides of the aisle who were willing to spend $6.4 trillion building up these other nations and not willing to invest here at home. And people are frustrated about it. They're mad about it when they saw that what, you know, these so-called experts were building up in Afghanistan collapsed in just 2 weeks. They have a righteous question on their hand, which is, what were you doing with all that money and all those lives and all that time? And so for us, when I go around the state, when I'm in St. Joe, when I'm in Hayti, when I'm down in Jeff City, like, people just want to invest here at home. They want to be told the truth. That's what I'm doing. And, you know, we are winning on that message, and I'm really excited about it.
So you say the need to invest here at home. So let's ask you this. We talked about inflation concerns earlier in the show. Were you to be in the Senate now and had a vote to cast, would you support President Biden's reconciliation package, the $1.75 trillion Build Back Better Act?
The thing about inflation for me is that, you know, why do things cost so much? It's because we don't make anything here anymore. And so when I see the fact that we don't make anything here anymore, I see a lot of our jobs being cut. I see a lot of good towns in Jefferson City that have fallen apart, or in Missouri, that have fallen apart because, you know, we're not willing to just make things here anymore. You know, Wall Street and these massive corporations have shipped things overseas. They've stripped our communities for profit. And so for me, I would go for anything that invests back here at home again, invests in production here at home again. You know, this is a national security issue. I mean, imagine if you're a general and you're in the United States military and someone says you have to defend Taiwan at all costs because they make all the semiconductors and our economy is going to collapse if we don't defend that place. Like, what a position to be in, right? When I led troops in Iraq on missions, the last thing you ever wanted to be in was in a position where you had absolutely no choice. And I can tell you what, right now, like, a war over semiconductors, if we, God forbid, end up there, is going to cost way more than the lives and the $6.4 trillion in the Middle East. And so we need to actually spend money investing here and making things here again so that our supply chains are restored and we don't find ourselves in this position where we're like fighting over things that we don't need to be fighting over, you know, destroying our planet at the same time and everything else. And so, you know, yes, I'll vote for anything that invests here in our country.
Lucas Kunz, thank you so much for being here today. Thank you for your service. Good luck with the campaign. Earlier in the show, we asked this. Why are you awake? One viewer emails, I'm awake on this Veterans Day, grateful for the service of many great Americans. And I'll add, both of my grandfathers served, a couple uncles, I am as well. Dan, what do you got back there?
I got one from Damon, who tweets, I'm a trucker helping to keep America moving. Listening to your live stream on my phone, I just passed Wells, Nevada on Interstate 80.
No supply chain issues with Damon. Thank you for listening. Drive carefully. I hope the really excited Charlotte Hornets announcer didn't distract you too much. Joseph emails this. I'm up way too early, 3 a.m. Mountain Time, to see if my fantasy football picks came through. Fantasy football waiver picks came through. Sadly, they didn't. I feel your pain. I also made a claim earlier this week that didn't go through, but sitting in third place, still in the playoffs, feel pretty good where I am. I got a lot of buys coming up. Won't be fun. Up next, a look at the Axios One Big Thing. You're not going to want to miss this one. And coming up on Morning Joe, retired U.S. Army Colonel Jack Jacobs joins the conversation to mark this Veterans Day. Plus, we'll hear from two members of the House, Majority Whip Jim Clyburn and Congressman Seth Moulton. Morning Joe, just a few minutes away.
Hey, everyone, it's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening?, we're back with another installment of our special series with Pod 2024, The Stakes. I'm talking to experts about both Joe Biden and Donald Trump's records on specific policy areas during their time as president. This week, economist Kim Clausing on taxes.
Underfunding the IRS really serves the interest of dishonest people at the top rather than your typical worker who would benefit from being able to get their questions answered and getting their returns processed in a quick way.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening wherever you're listening right now and follow.